So we're actually very lucky to have John Blow. That's the guy who's been sitting up here on stage all this time waiting to get started. We're actually really lucky to have him here. We had him here last year giving one of the morning keynotes, and it was very inspiring. Everyone really enjoyed his presentation. And we thought we'd have him come back and sort of do a follow-up and inspire us again. And he didn't want to come. He's like, well, geez, you know, to kind of be a good conference, don't you want new people to come every year? And so we had to twist his arm a little bit and say, well, we want you back. You're very inspiring. And John is really someone who I see as kind of the Plutonic ideal of an indie game developer. He's not an indie developer because, like, he couldn't get a job at EA or something. He's an indie developer because that's what he wants to be or wants to do, and realizes that the types of games that he wants to make, he kind of has to be independent and free in that sense. And really, he's been a champion, not only of indie games, but this idea of experimental games. Every year at GDC, he hosts the Experimental Gameplay Workshop, which is inspiring for many folks around the industry. And really, with Chris Hecker and others, started the Indie Game Jam. And that's sort of a model that other developers have been using around the world for experimenting with indie games. And for a long time, I think he was maybe accused of being too idealistic. And it's like, hey, dude, what did you ship? And now certainly having put Braid out and the massive success that Braid has received, I think he kind of, he seems to have a bit more of a skip in his walk than he used to previously. I think it was 93% Metacritic. That's the highest rated. Yeah. The highest rated XBLA title for sure, and it's kind of up there with the top 10, at least on Xbox, but certainly an awesome, awesome game. And so I don't really know what he's going to be talking about, but I'm going to be taking notes. So everyone, welcome John Blow back for a second year.
Well, I didn't quite realize this was supposed to be inspiration, or I wouldn't have had such a glaringly negative title. No. There is inspiration in here to be found for those of us who like to think about difficult problems. So my goal here in giving this lecture, and one of the goals that I have as an independent developer, is to try to figure out how to make games that can really touch people, that can change people's lives, or that can actually be genuinely important to them, right? Other media don't have any problem doing this, right? You might meet somebody, a real, ordinary, everyday person, who says, wow, a long time ago I read some book, and it was a really philosophical book, it was really meaningful to me, right? Or I heard some music that's been an emotional anchor to me, or I saw a film when I was very young, and it's really affected the way that I think for the rest of my life. You won't really hear people say that about video games unless either A, they're very young and impressionable and haven't seen much of the world yet, or B, maybe they're professional game designers and you'll say, oh, such and such game really influenced me. But usually they mean more of a professional, like game designer, cold kind of influence rather than a deep, hot, this is what my life is about now kind of influence. And how do we get that? How do we make things that are important to people, or profound, or meaningful? Well, that's too big of a question for me to answer, either in this lecture or elsewhere, but what I can do is talk about things that we do, as a matter of course now, that prevent us from meeting those goals, right? I believe that if we're going to make something that's deeply meaningful to people, it can't be fake, or at least overtly fake. It can't be unimportant, arbitrary, or careless, right? But as an industry, we have adopted design practices and just ways of making games that are ingrained into our core assumptions now that create things that are fake, unimportant, arbitrary, and careless. And the way to try to solve that is difficult, but that's what this lecture is about. So, if we want to make games that are important to people, there are actually two ways to do it, which is actually gives us an advantage over other media. We can do it by expression. You know, here I have a picture of some students watching a film. The film is expressing something to them. We can do that in a game with our audiovisual assets and the story and stuff. Another thing that we can do as a game that other media can't quite do is by introducing people to an activity, right? If you teach a young girl to swim and she becomes really good at it or just enjoys it, that might shape the rest of her life, possibly in a highly positive way, right? And you can actually see a reflection of this in two different different kinds of games that we have. On the left here, I have story games, right? These are games where there's often gameplay amid, you know, milestones of story, like Metal Gear Solid 4 or Grand Theft Auto 4 and things like that. There are also activity games that aren't based on story, right? Something like Madden, you don't play that for the story, or, you know, Wii Sports or Pac-Man, right? I'm going to be focusing on the kinds of games here on the left, which are a large fraction of what our industry produces. There could be a very, very interesting lecture, a very different lecture about the kinds of games on the right, but I don't have time to talk about those. Wish that I did. So the reason the subject is so interesting to me is developers are always trying to find ways to make better stories, right? Not even dynamic stories, they're certainly working on that, but just static storytelling. You know, if you go and play Valve's developer commentary in games like Half-Life 2, you can see all the steps that they took to convey their statically constructed story in the most efficient and impactful way, right? And of course in academia, we have plenty of academics. Where are my slides? They're gone. We have plenty of academics working on dynamic story techniques, right? And you can read lots of papers about those. So here's an example, again, of some of these games that we're all familiar with that use mostly static story in these examples, but we've also seen some games lately, like Fallout 3 and Far Cry 2, that attempt to do some level of dynamic story. What I have to say about all that is I think that story games are inherently conflicted. They have a structural conflict at so deeply ingrained a level that it's impossible to make them strong. It's impossible to make them, I won't say impossible, but it's very, very difficult to make them profound and impactful and deeply meaningful to people. We all know that stories in games aren't very good. Oh, why is that? Well, maybe it's just because we don't have good people writing stories and whatever. Maybe that's a little bit true, but I think it's also true because our medium prevents the stories from being good. And a large part of this lecture is going to be devoted to explaining how. So I think that if people sense that a work is conflicted in some deep way, they know that it can't be that meaningful or transcendent or profound, right? It'll be disharmonious and it won't resonate with them. What I'm going to talk about in this lecture could be viewed as just one problem, but I'm breaking it down into three subcategories so that I can get more specific and maybe talk about ways of dealing with different subparts of the problem, right? So the first conflict that I'm going to talk about is the meaning of a story versus the dynamical meaning of a game. And to do that, I'm going to have to talk about what exactly I mean by dynamical meaning in the first place. But first, some water. And I'm going to do this by moving away from the AAA games for a minute and talking about art games. There are many different kinds of art games. There are many different schools of thought, and the particular one that I'm going to talk about doesn't specifically have a name. These tend to be very small games made by one person or a small group. They tend to be made in a short period of time with a low budget, so they have low production values. And the particular games I'm going to talk about today are interesting in that they communicate themes and ideas through behavior and their core perceptual primitives rather than through story and dialogue and words. And by core perceptual primitives, I mean the sounds that are made or the shapes and colors of objects on the screen. Now, AAA games with $20 million budgets do this kind of thing too, but it's mixed in with all sorts of other things. And it's when you make a game this small, you get a certain clarity that you can't quite attain in a large game that takes 3 years to make. So I think I talked about this last year, but a quick recap for those of you who aren't here. This is a game called The Marriage by a guy named Rod Humble. And the point of this game is to communicate what Rod's marriage feels like to him. It's a free download on the internet. It's like very small. As you can see, there aren't any big graphical assets to download. When you start up this game, you just see the title of it, The Marriage. It fades out. And there's some dots moving around on the screen and a couple of squares. And the squares maybe catch your attention because they're moving away from each other. And you notice that when you move the mouse over one of the squares and move back toward each other. And so you see, I'm kind of a force of attraction between these two objects. And maybe since pink is a very stereotypical female color, maybe that represents the wife and the marriage, and maybe the blue square represents the husband, and they'll come together and then they meet and then they move apart again. And what is that about? And, you know, when they meet, the pink square gets a little bigger, maybe it's nourished by this interaction, and the blue square gets a little smaller, and what's that? And You know, so there's some dynamic that's unfolding as you play this game that is speaking to you about this marriage, but not in words. And the process of playing this game, whenever you come up to a new game, you have a process of seeing the first things that the game has to show you, decoding and understanding those principal communications. What's this game like? What do I do in this game? And this game overloads those initial steps with meaning. It loads meaning onto each perceptual primitive so that as you're figuring out how to play the game, you're also understanding the situation being depicted. Another game. So the marriage is a sort of very abstract. It doesn't feel that much like a video game. A lot of people who go to play it might not quite get it and give up very quickly. This game, Gravitation by Jason Rohrer, is much more accessible. When it starts out, you're in a place like the upper left corner there, except you can't really see very much. After walking around for a little bit, you realize that there's this big fireplace here, and there's this kid with a ball, and the ball is being thrown at you by the kid. And if you're in the right place, you can catch it and throw it back. And the music gets a little happier, and the world gets a little brighter as you do that, as you interact with this child. And eventually, you figure out that you can jump really high and even fly. And as you jump up, you can see and go into this maze in the upper right corner, which is perhaps a maze of thought or something like that. And you find these stars, and the higher you go, the more stars there are. But if you're up there too long, maybe your mood will start to sink because you're too far from playing with the child. As you run into these stars, you can sort of collect them, and they'll drop down to the bottom of the screen, depicted in that third image, and become blocks of ice. And if you push those blocks of ice over into the fire, they'll thaw, and you'll get points. And you discover all this by playing, right? There isn't an instruction book. You discover that you can only push the blocks to the right, but not to the left. You find that the number of points on the block will rapidly go down, and so if you drop several of them, and they become really hard to push, then you may get very few points for that, right? And there are these cold objects in your house that are hard to move, and you want to get them in the fire, but you also want to keep playing ball with your kid, and it's hard to do both at the same time, and what does that mean? And you can also run into a situation where you didn't plan things out well enough, and you've kind of made this wall of ice that stands between you and the child, and you can't get there, and now you're screwed because you can't score points, you can't push things out of the way, and you've just got to wait for things to melt, and your character gets really depressed. There are a lot of, for the small number of graphical elements and rules to this game, there are a large number of interesting, complex situations that you can enter into, and they're all meaningful. This is a free download from Jason Rohrer's homepage, and if you haven't played it, leave the lecture right now, go play it. So, I think they still have the Wi-Fi turned on, right? So now, Gravitation is a game that's carefully constructed out of behaviors or rules, and each of those rules have a certain meaning. Now, that's cool and all, but a consequence of that in terms of conventional game design is that if you decide to tune the game by adding or changing rules, suddenly you're changing the meaning of this work as a whole, right? So, you know, if before I started tweaking it, this was very clearly a game about inspiration and creativity and manic depression and the balance between family life and work life, right? Maybe I decide this just isn't quite going to hook people. I want the player to feel like he has more agency. I want him to feel like he can score a little more and have a little more power. So I'm going to add a one-time use power-up that's like bullet time, right? It'll like freeze time or maybe slow it down tremendously, and I get super strength, and I can push two or three blocks into the fire all at once. And that could be very interesting, right? I might want to plan out when I use that. But whereas, in my opinion, you know, if I'm some designer, I might think that makes the game more fun, I now have the problem that it makes the game less meaningful, right? Because what does that freeze mean? I invented it as a sort of gamer kind of operation for game design purposes, right? It didn't come from the initial idea of describing the interaction of a family with, you know, a working father. So, what have I done? I've maybe weakened the interpretation of the game, or maybe I've introduced an idea that's going to be misinterpreted, right? That can happen. So if I list out, here's a table where I'm listing out on the left, you know, with a lot of dots because I didn't want to type them all, but there's a bunch of rules making up this game, like the stars become blocks of ice, and the blocks could prevent you from reaching the child. And on the right, there's some interpretations that the player might form, and I don't know exactly what those are, but as the author, I can guess, right? So, you know, maybe I'm thinking that the stars are ideas, and as I bring them down into my house, they become concrete projects that I'm working on, right? But maybe in the third line there, when I designed this game, there was a bug that I didn't really observe, so I didn't fix it. That happens all the time, right? And I didn't see it, but maybe under some circumstances, a variable like flips over into a negative number, and the kid turns to the left away from me and stops throwing the ball, but just stands there. I don't know that that wasn't intentional necessarily, so I'm going to form an interpretation of that bug and kind of try to fit it into the rest of that story formed by the rest of the rules of the game. That is plausible as long as most of the game has a strong structure, and it seems reasonable to me that this bug fits in with the rest of the meaning of the game. But as I add more and more rules to this, it becomes less and less like a meaningful crystal of a game and more like an arbitrary mishmash. Right? Now, another interesting thing about games, because they're code, all programmers understand this, but it should be understandable by anyone. By adding and removing elements from a game, you can turn any game into any other game, right? If I wanted to make gravitation more like Pac-Man, I could add some dots on the floor that you pick up for score, right? 1 point per dot, and then maybe I'll take away the gravity, right? And so you can just walk around and the sky is not the sky anymore, it's like the ground, you know? And the first time I do that, maybe there's just dots, but the rest of the game is still gravity. The player might have some interpretation like, oh, you're cleaning up the house instead of playing with the kid, like the dots are trash or something, and I don't know why that's thematically important on the same level as the other stuff, but I'll take the author's word for it, right? but as you get more and more toward Pac-Man, the original meaning about the family interactions becomes less and less plausible, like as you add ghosts and power pills and stuff. But the point that I want to make with this chart is that you always have an interpretation, a potential interpretation for any behavior, any rule that you add to a game. And even if I delete all the gravitation rules and add all the Pac-Man rules, I have a game that's exactly Pac-Man, but that has an interpretation. And the thing is that in the games industry, we're just used to not paying attention to that interpretation, but it's there, right? Some people make jokes about it, like, oh, Pac-Man's a joke about drugs or something because you eat the power pills and go on a rampage. That's kind of a plausible interpretation of Pac-Man, sort of, right? And that's what I want to talk about. So for any game, right, any system comprised of behaviors, which I'll call a dynamical system, that system communicates something to the player, right? Whether you, as the author of the game, intended to communicate that thing or not. And you're not even in control of what it is because the interpretation is subjective, right? This is just like any form of art, right? I'm just restating this for games, but I'm saying that the gameplay does this, right? It's not necessarily just the story or the visual assets, okay? And this is what I'm calling the dynamical meaning. The dynamical meaning is whatever the coagulation of all these things in the right-hand interpretation column, if you put all those together, the intentional ones and the unintentional ones, the dynamical meaning is what you get. So if any of you have read Ian Bogost's stuff, he has this idea called procedural rhetoric, where you say things through gameplay. What I'm calling dynamical meaning is like that, but more vague and more fuzzy, because it doesn't have to be rhetorical, it doesn't have to be intentional, and it doesn't even have to be procedural. I think that procedures are an implementation detail, and what we really care about is behavior of a game system, which we usually codify in rules by writing programs, but it's not necessary. Behavior can just exist. So what I want to hammer home and beat like a dead horse is that gravitation conveys thematic elements to the audience, but it does not tell a story. Which brings me to that first conflict. I've just got done saying that every game has this dynamical meaning that arises from the rules of gameplay. And games that have story also have semantics of the story, right? The plot and characters and all that stuff, the mood that is trying to be imposed by this authored story. Whether it's pre-baked, right, pre-authored, or dynamic, that is happening, right? And conflict number one is that when we make games, designers are not used to thinking about this dynamical meaning, right? They kind of ignore it, and their main concern in this kind of situation is making a catchy story that players are going to think is cool, with compelling characters maybe, and they care about the gameplay too, but they want the gameplay to be fun, right? And I put fun in quotes because nobody actually knows what that means. Sometimes people pretend they do, but they don't. But we need to use that word, like as a matter of day-to-day existence in the game industry, right? We all know what fun is, even though we don't know what it is. So the point, though, is that the story and these fun game mechanics have separate meanings. Those meanings will often clash unless we work very, very hard to make them coexist. So this is a problem that we have barely noticed, right, as an industry yet. But it happens all the time, right? Because we're not paying attention, and it's a problem that other media that are mature do not have, right? If you're a director of a film, and a large part about the film of the film has been focused on some character that you want the audience to empathize with, and then at some point that character dies, and there's a funeral where other characters in the film who cared a lot about the dead character now are paying their respects. And it's a very sad kind of scene. Then when you go and you have the musician, you know, score that scene, you don't want him to play happy carnival music, right? Because it'll destroy the mood that you're trying to set with this funeral, this somber, touching mood, right? Unless you're David Lynch or something, you might do that on purpose to unsettle the audience and make them confused, right? Or make them feel very strange. But normally we don't want to do that, right? We only want to do it if we really mean to do it. In the games industry, we do that. We have like happy circus music over every funeral all the time, and we're like deaf and we have no idea what we're doing. So I'm going to get less abstract and more concrete and talk about how this manifests in a couple of popular games. And the first one is BioShock, and again I talked about exactly this problem last year, so I'm going to skim it really fast, but there are these little girls called the Little Sisters in the game who have been kind of manipulated in very unhumane ways by a corporation, but as a result of that, they have a resource that's very valuable to you because you're living in this rough world and you need to survive and get stronger, and this resource will help you get stronger. And the story, right, the voice acting and the animation and all that of BioShock presents to you this supposed dilemma that you need to kind of kill the little sisters, or at least some of them, and take away this resource so that you can be strong and survive, but at the same time, you want to care about them because they're just little girls who don't deserve to be mistreated. And so you have this decision. Do I be altruistic and take care of them and save their lives? Or do I do what I need to do to make it through the game and survive, right? So the game is trying to say that. But at the same time, the designers of the game felt it was important for the game to be balanced, right? And for the player to be able to survive through the game regardless of what choices he makes, right? So they built in some game rules such that no matter what you do to the little sisters, you'll always get about the same amount of the resource with a very small token difference. And game players notice this very quickly, and it feels weird. It feels wrong, right? Because on the one hand, the author of the story says, these little sisters are very important and you should care about them. And on the other hand, the author of the game design says, well, you could pretty much do what you want. You know, it doesn't matter either way. Just go for it, man. So that might work. You know, that might work well enough to do like a marketing campaign or something like, oh, there's a big ethical dilemma. But, you know, is that going to stand up 20 years from now or 40 years from now as like a great, touching, profound moment in video games? I don't think that it will. If it does, then hopefully I am not in video games at that point. A different one, right, Grand Theft Auto 4, has all these girls that you can go on dates with around the town when you're tired of going on shoot 'em up missions. You can actually go on dates with the guys too, but it's totally not gay. It's like cool and stuff. And most of these girls have, you can progress the relationship by going on several dates, and you'll eventually have some gameplay effect as a result of building that relationship, right? One girl might help heal you if you're in a troubled spot, right? Another one can call the DA and get the police to stop chasing you. All except for this one girl, Kate, who doesn't do anything. But you expect her to at some point. So you take her out on dates, 3, 4, 5. These things take a long time. You've got to go to the bowling alley and like do something and go play pool. And it's just, it gets tedious and you're like, Kate, like do something besides just say some canned piece of dialogue. But nothing. She'll never do anything interesting until at some point late in the story, spoiler alert, right? Not that the story, yeah, whatever. So there's this wedding where your cousin and some other girl are getting married, and your main character, who you've been playing and are supposed to be identifying with for the whole game, is talking to him and is like, yeah, there's this girl, Kate, who I really like, who I want to invite to the wedding. And as a player, you're just like, no. Kate is the most... The game designer taught me, expressed to me, that Kate is the most boring character in this game, who I have no reason to be with. And yet the person authoring the story decided that exactly the opposite was true, and that a pivotal moment at the end of the game was going to revolve around whether Kate lives or dies, right? So two people are trying to teach you two very different things, and they didn't notice, or they didn't quite understand. Maybe they made Kate non-functional on purpose so that you wouldn't use her, but you know, that just means that she's irrelevant, right? That she has no semantic meaning in terms of, or in terms of that dynamical meaning that I was talking about. So that's a clear conflict. I was going to do one from Half-Life 2, but I cut it for time reasons. If we do questions and anybody cares, we can talk about that. There are a lot of conflicts in a lot of games. Like I said, this is a widespread problem in the things that we make. I don't mean to pick on these particular games, except that I intentionally chose three games that are very highly rated and very financially successful, because I don't want to pretend like the problems I'm talking about are somehow preventing these games from being blockbusters, right? That's not at all true. But what is true, I think, is that these kinds of problems are preventing them from being coherent artistic works, right? From being meaningful, at least to me, and hopefully to a lot of people, right? Okay, so what I've said is there's this conflict between story and the dynamical meaning. How do you resolve it? Well, you might cut the story from the game, you might cut the dynamical meaning from the game, or you might make the two work together, right? Those seem to be the exhaustive list of what to do. So part A, don't use the story. What does that mean? Well, maybe you're building something like that game Gravitation or like The Marriage, but does that confine you to really small art games, or is there a way to scale that up, 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 until you're doing that kind of expression through, you know, core gameplay elements and core AV elements at a $10 million scale or AAA game scale that people are going to buy instead of GTA 4? I have no idea how to do that, right? Hopefully, maybe somebody will think about that, or maybe we'll eventually, sometime in the future, come to a time when people play 10-minute games or 20-minute games and feel fulfilled because of that, or one-hour games or two-hour games. I don't exactly know. But if we wanted to start to think in that direction, how do we do that? Well, what does a story do for people, right? And can we do the things that a story does in a way that does not involve story, right? Well, a story gives you interesting mental stuff, right? You want to know what happens next. You want to know what happens in the characters to the story. You want to know what they think about each other or what they're going to do to the environment or each other, right? Because we're kind of hardwired to think people are interesting. And a story also helps establish like lower level themes and moods that help just supply interest, right? So can we supply that kind of interesting mental stuff without a story? I don't know. I would like some people to work on that. I would like to work on it myself. And I'm not sure that that's the direction the industry is going to go, though, because, you know, I described Gravitation as like a little gem that's hard to construct. If you're going to scale that up and up and up, you're talking about something colossally difficult to construct just to get that same mental interest that you can get from putting a story in, right? But any dumbass can write a story for a game, and as you have seen from playing our games, a lot of dumbasses do. So, you know, like if an industry as a whole, like individuals can take a hard problem and work on it and do something awesome, right? But whenever you look at an industry as a whole and a bunch of people who just want to make money, the trend is going to be toward the easier thing that has the biggest payoff, right? And that's where it's going to go, is story in games. Like, so I'm not pretending that we can make large-scale games without story. I'm just saying I wish we would. The other option is not to have your game have a dynamical meaning. Well, I said that that's impossible, but what you can do is maybe make sure that there's no parts of that kind of fuzz out the dynamical meaning until it's in the background, like it has magnitude zero and doesn't interfere with your story. Then you could maybe have a strong story, except for the points I'm going to get to later in the lecture. That could be possible, but that kind of devolves to KC, managing the dynamical meaning, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, because it always exists. It's just getting it down to zero is like manipulating that meaning vector in a very specific way. But also, if you do that, if you say, I'm going to cut all the dynamical meaning out of my game, then you're essentially giving up on the idea that that gameplay can have meaning that was profound, right? Profound and meaningful was a target I set at the beginning of this lecture. If you say, I'm going to make it unnoticeable and like magnitude zero, then that's meaningless, right? That's the opposite of where we're trying to go. The story might be meaningful and profound, but then why is it in a game, right? Why didn't you just go make a film, right? Or write a novel or something? So the third option, which is kind of what we have to do, is tight coupling, which is what Ian Bogost calls it, which is when you just work really hard to make the story and the dynamical meaning cohere and not openly conflict with each other, right? And the problem is that's kind of like pressing bubbles out of wallpaper, right? You press one down and another one pops up over here because you end up changing aspects of the story that don't fit the gameplay and changing aspects of the gameplay that don't fit the story. And this is really hard because A, we don't have a culture of designers paying attention to dynamical meaning, like I was saying, but B, the AAA production model makes this very, very difficult because you often can't really tell what gameplay is going to be like until very late in a project, and it's often too late to make large changes at that point, and good luck convincing a team to make huge sweeping changes for some little, hey, you know, this dude said there's a conflict between the gameplay and the story, you know, we have to change everything. Like, you know, if you made a game and at the outset you wanted the game to be thematically about how technology alienates humans from one another or something, right? And then at some point, you know, you go on vacation as a lead designer and you come back and or you go on another project for a while. You come back very late in the game, and somebody has put a robotic sidekick into the game that's cute and tells jokes, you know, and that follows the main character around everywhere. And you're like, it's a robotic sidekick. It can't be humanistic and funny because that goes against the theme of the alienation of technology. We have to cut that and, like, replace it with, like, a sidekick dog, right, or something. But then it's like, oh, we have all these characters. We already wrote dialogue about how they make jokes about the robot and tell him he needs to, like, oil his brain or something. And that wouldn't make sense saying that to a dog, and we already recorded those in voice acting, right? And that's going to suck. And we designed all these levels that use the robot's tractor beam, and it doesn't make sense for a dog to have a tractor beam. Like, so what? Maybe he's a telekinetic dog? Like, I don't know. You end up, if you take this seriously, it's a tremendous amount of work that, quite honestly, nobody's ever going to do. Because it's not affordable, right? It's not feasible financially. Or in terms of reasonably spending the lives of the 100 people you have working on your game for 3 years, right? But if that's true, that's kind of a drag, because does that mean that we're kind of doomed to make these works that don't stand up for themselves? I don't know. So that one, story and gameplay conflicting, is one problem that I think runs very deep, and as I said, it's very hard to solve, but in theory, it is solvable, right? Given an infinite amount of resources, you know, manpower and time and all that stuff, you could come up with a very large-scale game that is perfect in that sense, and you could do it repeatedly forever, right? But the next things I'm going to talk about don't even make that possible. Like, so, yeah, I'll just start talking, and you'll get what I'm saying. So, the second conflict I'm going to talk about is called challenge versus progression. The progression comes from story, usually. It can come from other things, too. But here I'm going to focus on story, right? For a story to be interesting and compelling, it has to occur. Time has to move in the space of the story as you go through the game. You need to go from scene to scene to scene, right? But we also don't know how to make games that don't have challenge in them, right? There may be other ways to keep people interested in playing a game, but right now, we do it via challenge. Why challenge? There's a lot of people who will try to explain that to you, like maybe, you know, as we evolved, we kind of worked in this instinct for play in order to help us be more suited to real-world circumstances later when the playing helped us practice. That could be true, but there's a more fundamental reason, I think, that doesn't require as much supposition, and that's just that if there's a challenge in a game, it's a very obvious way of communicating to you that your interaction with the game is meaningful, that it's important, right? If I'm being shot at by guys and I don't duck behind cover or whatever, or I suck at aiming, it's very obvious that bad things are going to happen to me, right? So it's very clear that if I don't do the right things, there are consequences. And that's just a fundamental thing about game design that we do by reflex, and we kind of ignore that basic fact of clarity of consequences, but it's very important. Now, the problem is that for a story to occur, it has to keep proceeding to the right, which I've illustrated by drawing this arrow to the right. And the problem is that challenge is more like a friction force, right? Challenge is about preventing you from continuing in the game unless you meet some bar of performance, right? And story and challenge work against each other. No matter how hard you work on a game, well, No matter how hard you work on a game, if you've got a story in the traditional way, and you've got challenge elements in the traditional way that we use them, it's structurally unsound. It won't stand. Like, they work against each other. To put it a slightly different way, we often give story out as a reward, right? Like, hey, you got through this certain part, and we'll give you the next cutscene, right? And then, but challenge is about withholding that reward until you deserve it, right? So the story, when left by itself, would just go till the end, but the challenge is saying, no, the story can't go. And that's a problem. We've noticed that this is a problem over the past little while in the games industry. And we've come up with one solution that a lot of games seem to try to implement, which is to replace real challenge with faux challenge, right? So taking this big arrow, which represented a lot of friction force from challenge, represented it, or replaced it with a very small arrow, and then a big dotted, like, we're pretending that the big arrow is still there, right? And what these games do is try to seem like there's still a challenge, but actually make it very easy, right? It's the dramatic presentation of non-difficult things as difficult. This is what games like God of War and Fable 2 do. Like, there'll be a lot of enemies that run up and surround you, and it's a big battle scene, but really you just, like, hit the button a couple times and a lot of them die, right? So you feel like you're fighting, but you're not really fighting. It's like pretend fighting. Another way that this is done is dynamic difficulty adjustment, right? Where instead of requiring the player to increase their performance to meet some bar of difficulty, right, you lower the difficulty bar until the player can walk over it. Now, an interesting thing to note about this is that we can't actually use DDA or the dramatic presentation of difficulty. We can't actually use that to shrink this blue arrow all the way down to zero. Because for this big dotted, like, empty balloon of portrayed difficulty to exist, it has to have something inside, right? And if we take away all of the challenge, then people will see that, right? And they'll lose the sort of suspension of disbelief in the game. I would maybe more call it suspension of value system. So we all know when you read a work of fiction, you know that the characters in the book are not real, right? But you choose to invest in them as though they were real for a little while so that you can be enthralled by the story, right? So that you can care about what's going to happen next to them, right? There's a similar thing that happens in games. Like I said, challenge makes you feel like it's important what you do. You know when you sit down to play a game, it doesn't really matter that much what score you get or whether you make it to the end or something in the context of your external everyday life. However, we willingly put that aside and pretend like this game is really important for the duration that we play it. But that's only possible so long as the game is also complicit in that pretense that it's important. And if we let this arrow fall to zero, we lose our main method of keeping that pretense up. And the last thing I have to say about faux challenge, remember that list at the beginning of this lecture of ways not to be profound, right? Being fake was at the top of the list. So you may be able to be entertaining, right? You may be able to give somebody a power fantasy or make them feel strong or feel cool, but I don't think you're going to change somebody's life through faux challenge, right? It's not going to be that deep. People will feel that it's a surface thing. And lastly, I feel that challenge is actually very precious and that we misuse it. Challenge is one thing that games as a medium can do much more directly and much more extensively than any other medium, right? A film or a novel can be challenging, or music especially, I guess. We have the most examples of challenging music, in that you need to have a lot of education to understand it, or you need to invest a lot in trying to be there with it, right? But in games, we can directly feed challenge to the player and have them respond instantly all the time, right? So challenge is kind of our domain, and we ought to acknowledge that and understand that and treat it as precious, because if we're going to have a place in the world of art alongside other media, we have to play to our strengths and use them effectively. And we're not doing that right now. We're wasting it, and it's kind of a shame. Now, I've used the word challenge a lot, and that may make you think that I'm calling for, games must all be very difficult and frustrating to the player and stuff. I don't think that's true. A game doesn't need to be difficult, right? It just needs to be interesting. It needs to convince the player that their actions matter. And challenge is one way that we know how to do that, because we've fallen back on that time and time again over the decades. But I think there are other ways that we're only just starting to explore. Instead of presenting things as a like a violent, you better live up to this kind of challenge, or a hard, are you smart enough to figure out this puzzle kind of challenge, you can have things that are more like invitations, right? Open requests that the player step up to a certain level of performance for which there is a consummate reward if they choose to meet that level of performance, right? Maybe it's not even performance. Maybe it's, hey, I'm giving you this opportunity to expand your aesthetic notions of what is beautiful, right? Or what is interesting. Games can work in that space. And I could give a whole hour lecture about that, and I kind of did at the GDC this year, but it's not available online. Hopefully I'll put it up when I put this one up. So, third conflict, interactivity versus pre-baked delivery. And kind of dynamic stories too, although that's not in the titles. So, if we're using a story and we're trying to be meaningful to people, you know, often we're trying to create drama or some kind of, you know, crafted moments that land, you know, on the audience or are received by them in a way that we have crafted carefully. This requires a lot of technique, right? Pacing and framing and you know, setting things up. It requires delivery, as they call it, you know, in the stand-up comedy field, for example. You could have a comic stand in front of an audience and tell a bunch of jokes and nobody will think they are funny, right? And then you could bring in another comic, you know, next door, fresh audience, hopefully, and say exactly the same jokes, exactly the same words, but he will deliver them differently and more skillfully, and everybody will be just rolling, right? Same jokes. Well, what's the difference? Well, one guy just understands delivery. He understands how to set things up and pace them and frame them. And games don't let us do that because they're interactive. And interactivity directly sabotages this minute-to-minute delivery, which is the way that effective stories are told, right? This kind of technique doesn't just come into play in stand-up comedy, right? There are poetics that occur even in just written prose. There are sequences of ideas that are placed careful distances of each other. You know, if I write this sentence, I know that you read this sentence recently, or if I use this word, I'm going to use the synonym over here instead of the same word again. The context is used all the time, right? In games, you don't know where the player just came from, right? You don't know if he's holding a gun in his hand or some flowers, you know, you don't know if he's wearing like pants or what. As a designer, we could try to approach that problem and pre-author a bunch of content or think in advance about everything the player might do. But as we know, this invites a combinatorial explosion that we just can't deal with, right? You cannot think about all these things in advance. You cannot pre-bake that content. My favorite illustration of this is shown in these pictures here. It's a walkthrough of the game Deus Ex from the comedy site Old Man Murray, where their instructions to the player for the walkthrough, you know, in the beginning of the game, you go through this military base and you get all your instructions, and they said, hey, pick up that big American flag in the lobby and just stick it in front of everybody that you're about to talk to, right? And it makes every situation completely ridiculous, because you're talking to this guy and he's like, oh, Agent Denton, we need you to infiltrate the Statue of Liberty and kill all the terrorists, and you're going to need these weapons to do it. And he's like super like serious and stuff. There's this American flag that you're like waving in his face. And there was no way for the designers to anticipate that, right? This happens with everything in every game that we make, right? I just like this because it's an extremely prominent reminder of that. But there's also a deeper structural problem, right? So that's a surface problem, delivery, right? Interactivity also sabotages story at a deeper level, which you can illustrate with the classic idea of Chekhov's gun, right? Anton Chekhov said, if you say in the first chapter that there's a rifle hanging on the wall, in the second or third chapter, it absolutely must go off, right? If it's not going to be fired, it shouldn't be hanging there. So what does this do in linear media stories, right? The main point that Chekhov was trying to call attention to there is that it provides an economy of audience attention, right? If you just want to put cool stuff on stage and, I wanted this place to feel a little Old West, so I'm going to put a gun on the wall. Some people in the audience are going to be wondering, like, what's the deal with that gun? You know, they're going to be thinking about it. Whose gun is that? Who's going to use it? Because people like to think about people, right? And then the play goes on and nobody shoots anybody. And it's like, wow, that kind of pulled the audience's attention away from the things that the playwright was actually, and the director, were actually trying to have them focus their attention on, the specific relationships and specific things that happen, right? So this is a way of ensuring that you optimally use the elements in your play to focus the attention where you want it, right? That's how you, one fundamental technique of telling good stories. As a side effect, a lot of other good things happen as a result of Chekhov's gun, right? The gun provides foreshadowing because you are going to be thinking about it now, because that gun was put on that mantelpiece intentionally. So you're thinking, wow, who's going to use that? And who right now in this scene, when they're having this very mild but may lead to a bigger argument later, who's thinking about that gun in terms of the characters in the play, right? It also provides justification. If you have two characters at the end of the play and they both just have been hanging out and there was no gun and they're just arguing and all of a sudden one of them pulls a gun out of his pocket and goes bam and shoots the other guy, it's like, that's kind of a deus ex machina. It's like, where the hell did that come from, right? I had no idea as the viewer of this play that the stakes of this argument involved somebody getting shot. And again, you might do that intentionally, but very rarely. Usually you don't want to do that, right? Furthermore, so having the gun on the mantle provides that justification. Furthermore, in a good, well-told story, it is not an out-of-context gun like floating in the Matrix, right? It's like, it's got context, right? Why is there a gun on the wall? Well, it belongs to a hunter or an ex-military officer, right? Well, why is it being displayed? Well, either he keeps it ready to be used at a moment's notice, or maybe he's proud of, you know, having done something with it 10 years ago. But that's going to affect what one of the prominent characters in the play is who he is in the minds of the audience and the other people in the play. It's going to affect the setting. It's going to affect what the characters think about each other and the mood that they have of occupying this place. One decision like that affects everything in a well-told story, right? So Chekhov's gun and other techniques, which I'm not going to talk about because of time, requires an intense pre-process in order to generate a well-told story, right? So story is, in essence, a filtered presentation of events that have already happened, at least in the mind of the author, if not in the mind of the audience. Now, we can have dynamic stories, right? That's one thing that a lot of people propose to try to deal with pre-baked content kind of problems. We can't anticipate everything the player's going to do, but we can have a story adjust, give them more freedom, give them the feeling of being in a world where they have more agency, right? One thing that people say is if we just have AI that's good enough to do that, we'll be fine. I don't believe that, because a drama manager, which should be apparent, if you just look at Chekhov's gun for a bit, all those subtle changes that you make to make the story good require human-level AI, right? You have to solve what is called the hard AI problem, on which virtually no progress has been made for 50 years. So if you think that's going to happen anytime soon, good luck. If it happens, we'll have a lot more to worry about than just if our drama manager is good or not, right? We'll have much bigger ethical issues to think about in the world. So I'm kind of going to put that to the side. If that happens, this lecture is out of date. But even if you had a human quality drama manager, or if you had an actual human in the loop of your game making up the events, like you have in ARGs or something sometimes, right? That human can never even match the quality that you can get by having a human author a pre-baked story, right? Because he can't do Chekhov's gun properly. He can't do any of these structural storytelling techniques properly. He just has to dynamically adjust and do the best thing that he can do as time goes on, which is a subset and probably a weak subset of all the stories that you can tell if you can just tell any story. If you don't believe this, I want to bring up one analogy that may be clear to people who do programming or who do character animation. It's well understood in the world of animation that movies are always going to have better, more impactful, better looking animation than games will, right? And the reason is because movie animation is done in a pre-process. If you have some guy walking through a desert and he steps on a rock and his leg kind of twists funny, which happens all the time in animation tools, right? If you're making a movie, you're like, oh, cut that, rewind a few seconds, let's have him put his foot down in a slightly different place. Or if that looks awkward, if he doesn't look cool walking like that, let's just cut the rock out of the scene, right? Put it somewhere else, make that piece of ground flat. You can't do that in a game, right? But in a game, if that rock's there and you saw it there and the guy comes over to step on it, his leg's going to do what it's going to do, right? And you can't filter that in a way that will enforce your story in the way that you can in a film, right? So think about that conundrum there and just apply that to dynamic story versus static story. It's exactly the same issue. So to recap, here are the storytelling techniques we inherently suck at. Foreshadowing, justification, pacing, poetic and tonal adjustment of words for the context of previous words, which is part of that delivery stuff. Because we're so audiovisual in games, you know, vocal emphasis and body language is not just, you know, pre-baked stuff like that would be tuned by dynamic story as well. But the last thing, which is maybe the most important, is importance, right? If a story is just made up by a, you know, an AI drama manager, I just don't think that it can be as important as something that some person sweated over, you know, for 2 years, like squeezing blood out of a stone, trying to explain to you this thing that meant something deep to him, right? It's a different class of story. It's just not going to be as important to me. And if it's a static story, right, if it's pre-baked, it can't be that important because we shoved all this gameplay in the middle that interferes with it, right? If it was that important of a story, if it was that compelling for me to tell you this, then I would have told you that in a linear medium where the gameplay doesn't detract from it. Okay, so I can be any more abrasive. Dynamic stories are pretend stories. They're poorly structured, poorly delivered. Whether they are pre-baked or dynamic, game stories will always be awkward second fiddle to the stories told by linear media. They will always do it better than we do because we are interactive. Now, at the beginning of the talk, I showed a few of those games where the story is kind of part of the core value proposition, right? Like in Metal Gear Solid 4 especially, like the gameplay is kind of something that you buy the game for, but the big story, like what's Solid Snake going to do and what's going to happen to him, is a big reason why a lot of people buy that. If that is our core value proposition going into the future with our biggest money games, then our core value proposition kind of sucks, right? And it'll make us money, but it won't let us touch people authentically and deeply, right? Because we're not being authentic and deep. We're not allowing ourselves to do it. So I'm back to what I said originally, like I've come out all anti-story here, and I personally would like to find an effective way to not use story in bigger games or in more compelling games. And I don't know how you scale up gravitation to the size of something like Metal Gear Solid 4, but I'm interested to try, and I welcome anybody out there who likes hard problems to try too. Another solution to this problem is to just take a very different approach to story, right? So Steve Gaynor, one of the designers for Bioshock 2, said this on his blog. Video games are not a traditional storytelling medium per se. The player is an agent of chaos, making the medium ill-equipped to convey a pre-authored narrative with anywhere near the effectiveness of books or film. Rather, a video game is a box of possibilities, and the best stories told are those that arise from the player expressing his own agency within a functional, believable game world. So in the worldview that Steve is expressing here, it's not so much when you make a game that you're going to try to present a story to the player, you're rather giving them something with which they can create a story either for themselves or their friends, right? And this is a way, you know, Will Wright has given lectures before where he talks about this is one of the things that people find valuable about The Sims, right? They like to tell stories to other people and make presentations about what happened to their Sims. I don't know exactly where that worldview fits in terms of attempting profundity or attempting deep meaning, but, you know, maybe there's somewhere to go there. The last thing, you know, I asked this question before, what does story provide and can we provide it in a different way? Usually when we think about this, we focus on linear media that have stories, that have plots, right? All of the conflicts that I was talking about before come from, or at least gain their large magnitude, from the fact that they're about sequences of events over time, right? And interactivity doesn't let you predict sequences of events over time. There are many other forms of art that plenty of people would say are plenty profound, plenty deep, and that they were deeply moved by, like music and sculpture and painting and all kinds of things, right? That we as designers do not very often look to for reference. And we sure could, right? I think that we're a little too much steeped in the movie culture, right? Mainly the movie culture, you know, sometimes the book culture. We could do well to get far, far away from that in the future. And I think that these art games are a good first step at trying to move away from that. I don't know how far we can go in that direction. I'd like to see us experiment a lot. But if this kind of experimentation is going to happen, which sort of brings me to my last point, we art game authors need to abandon the message model of meaning, right? The way that I described both of these games, they were very carefully crafted in terms of each gameplay rule meaning a specific thing. And that can be very interesting, but it can also be taken too far. And I think it already has been taken too far in terms of some of the less skillful art games that have been produced lately, right? I think if you're trying to be deep or meaningful, the message model of meaning is an insufficient way to make games, right? And what is that? Well, you know, we all know there are little fables for kids and stuff that have some short, easy to understand story, and it ends like, hey, the moral of the story is people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, right? And you're saying something to somebody, perhaps in a condescending way, like, hey, I'm smarter than you, and I'm telling you something that you should live by. That's kind of insulting, right? A little bit. Like, if you can't talk to a peer that way. You talk to a child that way. And a lot of gamers get mad at the idea of art games, partly because they think we're trying to take away their fun, but partly because I think they do anticipate being condescended to. And sometimes they're right, right? Sometimes we would do well to actively try to avoid that model of condescension when creating something for an audience. The other problem with the message model of meaning is that it trivializes meaning, right? Like in high school, in America at least, I was taught to read notable books and then write these 5-paragraph essays that explain very redundantly and very boringly what the book is about, which is bullshit. Like, you can't... If you could say what the book was about in the 5-paragraph essay form, then the author of the book would have just written a 5-paragraph essay explaining to you the thing. He wouldn't have written a 300-page book, right? But he felt the need to write that book. And why are you trying to... I don't know. Never mind. But... So that sucks. And my friend Frank Lance explained it very well and very poetically when he said we should be aiming for meaning which is less specific, less concrete and deliberate, harder to define, harder to pin down, a meaning that transcends the author-reader conduit model of message-style meaning, a meaning that absorbs intention but is not bound by it, a meaning that can't be reduced to a claim about the world but is no less about the world because of it. All right. If we can do that, I think we'll be okay. So I think when somebody sits down and tries to make one of these games with a message model in mind, he's deluding himself at least a little bit. Because the true meaning of a game, that aggregation of all those right-hand side columns of interpretations of all those game rules, is always going to be much more complex than whatever you set out to build, right? Not just because the player will have his own interpretation, but because very quickly the combinatorics go through the roof and you can't predict what people are going to see and what they're going to do, right? I'm okay with that. My attitude in making games is, you know, much like I was saying about the 5-paragraph essay, if I can put all this meaning into a little box and wrap it up with a bow and hand it to you and say, here you go, here's my message for you, you can fully understand this just by opening the box and looking in, it can't be that important, right? Because I'm just some guy. Like, if I understand something, it's not going to be profound, right? It's not going to be... something deep about the world or about things beyond the world, right? So my model for what I try to do, rather than taking a message and putting it in a box, is maybe try to find something I don't fully understand, right? That's worth communicating to somebody, right? Like, I don't quite understand this thing over here, but it seems very important to me. And I can point at it, like, it's over there. Like, can you see it? And not everybody will be able to see what I'm pointing at, right? But some people will. Some people will see it and they'll see maybe more of it than I do or different parts of it than I do. And in their play experience, they'll build up a different perspective on this thing that I'm pointing at than I had. But they'll be kind of seeing the same thing. And we will have this kind of communication that is very rare and very precious. And I think is one of the things that we can aim for or should be aiming for if we want our medium to be anything but, you know, trivial enjoyment. So... I just said that if I can say things, if I can make concrete statements, they're not, they can't be that important, right? And I spent most of this lecture making statements about story. So I would like to end it with a question about something that I don't completely understand, but that I would just like to offer, right? Early in the talk, I said that, you know, all these rules in games like Passage are very meaningful. And if you just want to be a game designer, like, and add this kind of gamer rule that makes the gameplay more cool, but that disregards the meaning, then you maybe damage the meaning of the work or make it more muddled, right? Maybe, but maybe not, right? What if you designed a game that was very clearly meaningful, right? It had a sound, solid structure. It didn't have any conflicting elements. And then you inserted a gamer trope, like we're all familiar with, like invulnerability or, you know, super strength or bullet time, that clearly had no place in that, right? Could you use that as a lens to observe all of the things that do belong in that structure of meaning, right? Could you use it to use our medium to investigate these themes, say, of family and relationships between work and home in a different way, in a way that people would have never expected, right? Because if I make a game like this, and every rule that I ever express comes from this one solid picture that I have that I'm trying to communicate to you, then I could do something very touching and personal, right? And that's valuable. And that's one model of art, right? But one other thing that I can do is, try to introduce some kind of external perspective, some way to use the game as a medium to step outside of my internal mental structure of what family life is about and escape it, right? And I haven't explained that very well, but I'm going to leave it at that. Thanks very much. If we have any more time, we can take questions. Darius.
Hi, John. So you were talking a little bit about drum managers. And
sure.
And I agree with you that like a drum manager won't do a good job on any given playthrough of a game making a really interesting story. But what about exploring the space of that drum manager, right? Like playing multiple times through.
Yeah, because this lecture, so the question was about, does meaning arise if you use a drama manager over and over that doesn't arise from a single story? And absolutely yes. I think that's a very good direction to explore. It's, I would have talked about that too if this lecture wouldn't have been 5 hours long. There's a certain kind of communication. Like one kind is, hey, like the marriage, where you can play the game once, and if you're an effective player, then you understand it, right? Pretty reasonably. There's another kind which is about, hey, I'm communicating to you the dynamics of this big system. Maybe I'm making a weather game. It's like an edutainment game, and I want to teach you how the weather behaves when you do certain things. And that requires many playthroughs to build up a mental model of the system, right? And in that kind of model, dynamic story could perhaps express something very deep. Like I could make a relationship game where you go out and you date people and you try to get married and stuff, where relationships always end in failure, right? And you won't understand that from one playthrough, but from many playthroughs you will. But that's using dynamic story in a very different way than I think a lot of people think about it, right?
Thanks.
Yeah. I don't know who was first, so...
I wanted to ask you about Shadow of the Colossus. Now, I know it's an author game. I know it's set. The options you have are basically kill a bunch of guys. But it still delivered a sense. I wouldn't say meaning, but at least it had a strong reaction in a lot of players. And it doesn't seem to be particularly innovative, except that it's very well polished.
Right, well, so innovation is totally orthogonal to what I'm talking about, right? So these art games that I showed and talked about at length are innovative, but that is not why they're interesting for the purposes of this talk, right? It's the actual conveyances that they engage in.
Well, like I'm saying, it actually hit me on a story level. I felt compassion.
Sure. The thing that I think about Shadow of the Colossus is it would have been a much better movie than a game. Like I played it about, I played it until about the sixth Colossus, and I really wasn't digging that gameplay. I thought it was not very interesting or fun, and I thought that, I wanted to know what happened next in the story, but the game said, if you want to know, you have to go through more than you're willing to go through. And I said, sorry, So. If there's a Shadow of the Colossus movie, I might go watch it, but, So that's the question. So for any particular game that has a story, you could say, wow, that story was pretty meaningful, right, to me. Would it have been more meaningful if well executed in the context of a linear story? And you could say, You know, what many game designers say is that because I killed those colossi, right, and, you know, because I didn't play it to the end of the game, but I know what the spoiler twist is, right? Because I killed those colossi, I'm more involved, right? Which is true, but so far to me, that has not played out to the level that people expect it to. Like, I've never been personally moved deeply by, a game the way that I was about a book or a film. And that's why I'm here giving this talk. If there are people who claim to have had that experience, cool. You don't have that problem, and great. But I would claim that for the vast majority of the population, if we want to reach most of the population as artists, then we need to know... Well, now we start getting into all other like issues about how big should your audience be and stuff. But if, I don't know, I said all I'm going to say on that. Yo. Yo.
I just got to ask, in Braids, what is the dynamical meaning of the panoramic fans coming out of the Greenwood fights? It kind of meant to me the game designer really likes Mario.
Well, I don't want to spoiler anything, right? And I don't like to talk about the meaning of Braid very much, but I'll say something very simple, right? So in terms of the enemies of the game, there are not very many, and they're divided into a small number of categories. So this is going to be really stupid for anyone who hasn't played Braid. But the plant is like the lowest level one. It's simply a function of T, so it's symmetrical with respect to rewind, right? Other enemies, you know, there's one guy who moves through space but doesn't have volition, right? He just always, you can predict what he's going to do based on where he goes, and then there's one more enemy that makes choices. So it's about, you know, exploring the meaning of those different kinds of behaviors within this space where time manipulation happens.
I was curious, as you discussed this meaning that's broad enough that people will draw different things from it. Do you think you achieve that in Braid?
You mean, did I make a game that different people draw different things from?
I mean, did you achieve in what you just said you wanted from games? What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. In terms of, not in terms of everybody who played the game, right? Certainly. In terms of, did a significant percentage of the audience get a significant amount of what I wanted to point at? I think they did. How many of them got everything? Very few. I have heard from people who did, though. A lot of the things that I've talked about here in terms of, you know, not handing you something in a box are ideas that I came up with while developing that game. Like, I developed that sensibility, and the reason why I still... have that sensibility as opposed to having abandoned it is because I'm happy with how that went, and really wouldn't go back to a simpler model of things.
Hey, John, thanks for the talk. So here's something that occurred to me while I was listening to you talk, which is if you read books and stuff about how great film stories are concocted, like you hear a lot of talk about how they're actually sort of a participatory dialogue that shows different views on one subject, so you're kind of looking at it from different angles. So like instead of being pedantic and just like coming out with a message, like you're posing a question and allowing the audience to explore it, right? And you also hear that is they're sort of like the compressed, distilled moments of life that sort of like are sort of supernaturally meaningful. Like instead of just like a regular life that's sort of like unraveled, it's like compressing the most meaningful times of your life, like the most important decisions and so on. So that's some traditional storytelling technique that goes into a film script. Do you think that's a workaround? Like because they only have 2 hours of your attention. And in fact, like an unraveled, like real life story is actually more natural, and therefore all that stuff you're talking about, drama management and well crafted stories, is actually like a workaround to something that's more natural?
Well, so the thing that I was told when in my very brief fiction writing career, right, was that, you know, we kind of pre-filter for the stories that are most interesting, right? Like most fiction is not slice of life because people don't exactly want to spend their time, like you said, it's not even just that you only have 2 hours in a film or something, but that people walking around have day-to-day concerns and they have a choice about whether to invest the time in understanding your story, right, in living your story or whatever, and doing something else, like going and playing baseball or whatever, right? So you have to catch them, and most people don't want to spend most of their time reading the average day-to-day occurrences of an average person. Sometimes people make films or stories about that that are very poignant, but those are still focused in a certain way, right? So if you were to have, like, in some sense, like a physics engine is a drama manager, right? It's a very weak one in that, hey, I dropped this box and it hit on the corner and it rolled, and it's computing events that happened as a result of something that make narrative sense, right? It's just not something that you want to spend that much time with unless you like knocking things around. It's not going to give you higher level meaning, right? So, yes, I think the structure of story traditionally is a workaround for the fact that people have limited attention. But that's what stories are. Stories are that workaround. That is, stories are, I thought really hard about something that's worth telling you, and here it is, right? And drama managers are trying to do the same thing, right? Did that answer the question, or?
Yeah, no, that did.
Yeah, okay.
So that's actually a really good lead into this question.
Awesome.
You said, you know, about how a physics simulator is kind of a crappy drama manager. What do you think about dynamic systems that are story-shaped to use, and what do you think about application of those systems? For example, the best one I can think of is the sort of high-level dynamic system of game progress, game state, in a game of Civilization, which is tends to be shaped into a three-act structure. It tends to favor events that are mechanical betrayals and reversals of power. It tends to cause you to feel relationship-like feelings with aggregate individuals who are comprised of lots of small little actions. It really is very story-shaped, and yet I wouldn't call it a drama manager, and I think it's a very powerful system that makes me feel very powerful things that aren't authored.
Yeah, so that, in terms of where I draw the lines, I would put that into the category of, you know, getting some of the payload that story gives you with something that's not quite a story, right? You know, those senses of conclusion or comeuppance or, you know, coming back from a loss that you might have in a good story are available in that structure, right? At the same time, you don't exactly buy that game for the awesome characters, and you don't want to know what happens next in the same way you do in a story, right? You want to know how you can make something happen next, or, you know, so it's different. And I think that when, you know, remember my whole mission statement was about trying to be deep and meaningful, right? And I think the meaning in such a system eventually comes from a different place, right? It doesn't exactly come from one story. It comes from the system and the dynamics of it in that way that Darius was suggesting. And you could gain some kind of understanding or vision of the world from playing that game many times. You could get a glimpse of it from one playthrough, right? But you still understand it as kind of a glimpse, and you're like, well, what if I had done these other things, right? And maybe, you know, so maybe in some, like, if we somehow all had infinite quantum supercomputers for brains, right? And we wanted to author a conventional story, but made it a hyper story, right? And put branches everywhere, and every branch was like fully Chekhov gunned all to hell, no matter what the player did. Maybe such a thing is possible to exist. I don't even know. That would be like the story version of the same kind of thing that you're talking about, right? Where you can see things from different perspectives on different playthroughs and feel out the space. But to me, a story, you know, I don't know, we start talking about branching story and stuff, but there's a line there somewhere between the system and the story. I don't know. Go ahead and follow up if that wasn't satisfactory.
What I was interested in was just your thoughts on the utility of using high-level management systems like that to emphasize other dynamical meanings in your story. Imagine having a high-level manager, not of story elements, but of gameplay elements in brain, so that things reach more compelling climaxes around events that you have detected are particularly potentially compelling for the player in order to give him catharsis and realization and reversal and things of a different nature that are really important.
So for me, that's not that interesting. I see that is a useful thing to do, especially from an entertainment perspective. I view that kind of, at some sense, it's we'll call it moment by moment catering to the player experience or whatever, right? Like I said, that's different in importance to me than, damn, I had this story I really had to tell you, right? And so I think that it has entertainment utility. I haven't seen that be profound in the way that I'm talking about. There may be a profundity there, like somebody who's like Pele or something, who's really awesome at playing soccer and who wins some game one time that he really cared about, might have a way more profound experience and feeling than any of the novels that he's ever read or anything, right? But I would almost put that into a different category at that point. And then I feel like trying to engineer that loses honesty somehow. I could be wrong, right? But every game that I've played that done it felt dishonest. Yeah. Oh, and one more thing, though, is just that there could be profundity in that system, but not in the story that results from the system, right? In that same way that, like, a game of Civ has something. Like, I think that you could build that, but I wouldn't care about the surface story. Maybe that's just me.
Thank you. My question, well, is more of a point of clarity. There's, in the third problem that you talked about with the, with the first slide you mentioned about, you know, taking the bubbles out of the wallpaper in terms of, you know, not putting something into a game that you purposely want there, you know, and kind of controlling that tightly. Is there a contradiction there with the issue of not trying to get a message across that you were talking about in the third slide, insofar as, you know, how does someone create anything without really, you know, us all being socializing and getting this?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a difference between creating something that has a known meaning that you intend and that you expect the player to get, and like force feeding that down someone's throat, or, you know, I don't know. There's some line there, right? Like I was saying, for me, you know, I got done making a game that had very specific meanings behind things, right? It wasn't just arbitrary for the player to interpret however they want. I mean, they obviously will, but I had things that I intended, but it wasn't a closed box. It wasn't a closed system. It extended beyond what I put in there, right? And I think that that's the kind of thing that developers need to think about.
Thanks. I could just ask another question. In regards to what the gentleman was asking, you talking about, you know, Pele having a profound experience but not in the same way as the story, do you think that someone like C.L.R. James, you know, talking about sport as art and talking about how that experience can have a story, do you think he would disagree with that in terms of artistic experience?
It's a hard question to answer because I haven't read the source material, but I've encountered a lot of people who have different opinions of what a story is. Like, some people would say that every soccer game is a story because it's like a series of events. My opinion is that it is not a story. It is events from which we can derive an infinite number of stories based on what we choose to emphasize and de-emphasize about that soccer game, or what we were paying attention to and what we were ignoring, right? You know, if a soccer game is a story, then everything's a story, right? Like, you know, that bottle of water sat there on the table for hours, the end. Like, that's not that great of a story, so I don't know. But even that sentence I made is different from the fact of the bottle of water sitting on the table, right? I would not ever call that a story. So I would say that a soccer game can make a great story, but it is not one in and of itself. Chris?
Could you comment on the concept that, like, the fact that the player is in the loop and the story, or whatever you want to call it, is personal to them? It's kind of like no one thinks their kids are ugly. Like, you get a certain bonus because the player more than experienced it or created it or improvised it or whatever, as opposed to like a kind of top-down authorial thing.
Yeah, well, that a little bit, let me go back to the beginning of the lecture here for illustration. Remember, I was dividing things into activities and expression at the beginning, right? And at some point, you know, Spore, for example, or Little Big Planet, you know, Little Big Planet has, they both have very strong game components, right? And like expression in them, which is You know, Little Big Planet has a very playful character that's being expressed to you from the minute you put in the disc and load it up. But then there's a lot of freedom there, right? There's a lot of... I don't know. Maybe I'll drop these examples, because those are more about UGC than dynamic plot, but it's kind of the same issue. It's like, you're invested in the personal aspect of UGC, you're invested in the personal aspect of a dynamically created story, but that almost becomes an activity, like a... Slide's not up, but... a creative endeavor, rather than... an expression, right? The more, if you want to take Doug Church's abdication of authorship, right? The more authorship you abdicate and create freedom for the player to have their own experience, the more you're moving into this activity neighborhood and away from this expression neighborhood. And there's a lot of stuff there, and I just chose not to talk about it in this hour because this hour was full, right? But not to totally feel like I'm dodging the question. You know, it's kind of like I was saying to Clint and Darius, like, I feel that the standard approach of dynamic story is not that great. You know, we want to create profundity and we need to be thinking in different directions, but, you know, what those might be, it is more about seeing the hypersystem, you know, as opposed to seeing the individual telling. All right. Thank you very much. Oh, wait, we got one more. Sorry. Two more.
I just wanted to clarify something. I didn't talk about the quote, that essentially what was necessary was meanings that were hard to pin down. And I was just wondering if, where I thought you were going with that, is that actually could be a substitute for what challenge provides in the video game. In other words, what challenge sort of provides a reminder of what we're doing is meaningful as we progress through the game. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure that I understand the question.
Okay.
The so challenge... is,
you pretty clearly showed why you thought challenging piece... impedes progress of story narrative in the games.
Sure.
And, but one of the last slides you showed was a quote, I think, from a friend of yours, saying that what was necessary was stories that provided meaning that was harder to pin down. So what I'm wondering is that, could that sort of, could that, the fact that the story of the narrative is actually hard to discern, be the thing that reminds the player that what they're doing is meaningful in the absence of challenge as they progress through it?
Yeah, it certainly could be. That would be one type of game that, you know, you could start out and say, I'm going to design a game that does that, right? And it's going to do it really well. You can't think of a game that has, right?
I mean, it seems like it would be really difficult to do.
Yeah, but I would fully encourage, if anyone wants to do that, go for it. I'll totally play that game, you know. There are a lot of approaches to what, to get around the issues that I'm talking about, right? Yeah, and no way could I ever enumerate them all, because I don't know. Yeah.
I know you had mentioned that if we came back to this, that Jay would want to know what had happened with Half-Life 2 that you were very critiqued, and was asking about it, that you'd go back and actually cover what you saw as the flaws in it?
Yeah, well, there are many flaws in all those games, right? But the one that I was going to talk about in Half-Life 2 is there's a fundamental tension, again, between the story and characterization and the structure of being a first-person shooter, right? So Half-Life 2 is one of the newer in a very long line of evolution of first-person shooters where certain design standards have been adopted, right? And the one that's being used there for much of the game is, you know, you're in an arena, there's a locked door preventing you from going to the next arena yet, and you've got to, like, fight some monsters or, you know, bring an object to a location which involves fighting off the monsters on the way there or whatever to open the way to the next arena, right? And that does a few things, right? That structure helps pace out the game. It helps the players understand what they need to do, right? They need to get through this arena and the next one all the way to the end. And it helps provide structure to balance the game, right? So when you enter one of these arenas, or you know, say you have this fight, I don't know how good of a player you are. I don't know what difficulty level necessarily you're playing on and how good that level is for you, but you're going to get a little different level of damage and hurt and use a different amount of ammo. I can put ammo on the other side of that door, and you can't use it in this fight, so there's some challenge. But as soon as that door unlocks, you'll get replenished, right? So it provides structure to help me keep the level of challenge appropriate, right? The fact that you can't just walk to the end of the game. So this is very rigid first-person shooter structure happening. at the same time, and then the one more thing to say about that is, you as the player have this idea in your head about what it means to be a good player of this game. This is kind of a competitive game, even single player, right? If I'm good, it means I'm not getting hurt that much, I'm not dying, I have high health, I have a lot of ammo, yeah, I'm getting through these areas really fast, I'm killing these guys fast, and I'm going to get toward the end of the game because I'm going to beat the game, right? That's what it means to be a good player of this game mechanically. It's what the game mechanics are teaching you is important. So you get to one of these locked doors and you're like, man, I can't wait to get on the other side of that door because it means I'm good because I'm getting further, and it means I'm good because I've got all these riches in terms of ammo and health and stuff, right? So that's all the game mechanics. The story is like, hey, there's this Alex Vance hot chick who we want you to empathize with and you know, to accompany you through the game, and we want you to feel things for her. So we're going to have some kind of touching dialogue that happens, and maybe she'll tell you some other things about the world, about what happened while she was away and talk to some other characters and things, to try to establish more story. She's like traveling story to go with you, right? Now, these elements of story can't happen during the firefights, right? Because they don't know where you're looking. You're not going to be able to hear her because your machine's going off and it's really loud and there's like, you know, an alien beast jumping at your face. You're not going to be paying attention to what she's saying, right? So they have to, these story elements, large downloads of information and attempts to get you to care about the character have to happen between firefights, right? And what's between firefights? Those doors that you want to get through. So one of Alex's things that she does in Half-Life 2, especially the episodes, is she unlocks that door at the end of the arena, right? But she can't just go unlock it because she's got a monologue to deliver, right? So it's like, oh man, the door's jammed. Let me try and figure this out. By the way, did you hear that Dr. Kleiner got a new girlfriend, blah, blah, blah. And she's just talking and talking, right? Or it'll be like an elevator that takes an hour to get to the floor. And you're like, shut up. I want to get through the door, right? In terms of the game mechanics, all you want is to get through the door and get the things. You worked really hard, right, as a player. You took damage to get this reward that you know is on the other side of the door because you've been taught by the repetitiousness of the game design. And Alex is actually, even though the writers of the story and the animators and stuff are working really hard to get you to empathize with her, she's standing between you and your goal at every waypoint. So that's the fundamental tension.
Thank you.
Sure. You can see why I cut it. It's a really long explanation. All right, thanks very much.